From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
This is a humanitarian crisis, a crisis of the heart, and a crisis of the soul.
President Trump in his address from the Oval Office there on Tuesday, and in fact, there is a humanitarian crisis growing on the southern border. For example, tens of thousands of migrant families crowded into bare detention facilities that weren't designed to hold women and children. But a Department of Homeland Security official recently told the New York Times that the crisis is being caused by the Trump administration's own policy. Quote, it's the complete 100% focus on harsher options with a disregard for managing what's happening, the official said. Well, today the president visits the border, so we wanted to get a detailed look at what's actually happening on the ground there. This hour on Point, the reality of the crisis at the border and its causes. And you can join us. Do you think the Trump administration is taking the right approach at the border? Who do you think or what do you think is causing the crisis there? Do you even see one? Is it a crisis of immigration or crisis of the heart, as the president said? And how do we fix it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today from San Diego, California, is John Burnett. He's NPR's Southwest correspondent. He was embedded with Border Patrol yesterday and recently also reported from Tijuana, where he spoke with migrants waiting for who are seeking asylum. We've got links to John's reporting at onpointradio.org. John, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Meghna.
So first of all, let me ask you, you just yesterday were embedded with Border Patrol agents. Tell us a little bit about what you saw and what they were telling you about how they see this crisis, if they even do see a crisis at the border.
Yeah, it's, you know, every sector of the southwest border is a little bit different, Meghna. Mm-hmm. And so the situation over here is rather different from what we're seeing, for instance, in New Mexico, where you have these large groups of migrants, lots of children traveling without parents and families crossing, and some of them very ill and growing even sicker in these Spartan Border Patrol facilities. That's over, west of El Paso. Out here in San Diego, I spent 7 hours with a couple of agents yesterday, and we drove literally from one end of the sector to the other. It's about 60 miles long, and it's so interesting because really I kind of felt like the ride-along that I had was playing off of the president's emphasis in his national address from the Oval Office on the need for a border wall. Mm. What you have out here is a sort of a show and tell of what a wall accomplishes. We can remember those iconic images back in the 80s of mainly Mexican immigrants who were all sort of trotting across the hills, you know, just off Imperial Beach, headed towards San Diego, and agents could do very little to stop them. Well, since then, they have these really formidable walls that they have. You see them under construction, these 18-foot-tall steel bollards filled with concrete and rebar with these anti-climb sheets at the top and buried 6 feet in the ground. And so they wanted to show that here these walls work and they really do divert illegal crossers into other areas. But in terms of a humanitarian crisis, which is what you asked mm-hmm. me, right across the border in Tijuana, which is Mexico's sixth largest city, you have still around 2,000 migrants from the Central American caravan who've now been there going on 2 months. And conditions are not good. They're rather squalid in some of the refuges, some of the shelters that I visited. And so they continue to wait their turn in line, to trickle into the United States, and to cross illegally.
Okay, so I definitely want to hear more from what you saw in Tijuana mm-hmm. here. But let's play a little bit of tape from Chief Patrol Agent Rodney Scott, who you spoke with when you were embedded with Border Patrol. And he told you why he thinks the agency needs more fencing when it's expensive and that agents already have operational control, he said to you, if I understand this correctly, between Tijuana and San Diego. So here's Chief Patrol Agent Rodney Scott.
Customs and Border Protection has had this systematic plan that we've been acting on for years, building out infrastructure where we believe we need it. And all of a sudden, it got unbelievably political overnight as opposed to what we're saying that we need.
So, John, tell us more about what Rodney Scott was telling you about that he feels it's gotten unbelievably political.
Right. Well, it's interesting because the context of that quote is we were in eastern San Diego County, in an area that's very remote, that does not have fencing. And I was asking him, why do you need this incredibly expensive fencing that if you work out the arithmetic on the president's numbers, it's $24 million it averages a mile. Even the fence, this formidable fencing they're building south of San Diego is $10.5 million. So, you know, why is it more than twice that much? And he was saying that under the Obama administration, the chiefs all along the border just never asked for border barrier because they knew they were not going to get it because the administration was not open to that kind of request. And that now Trump is friendly to a wall. And he was saying that the chiefs know that walls work, that they want barriers. And the reason they want them is because if you put them up in an area, people can't get over them, and so you're able to move some of the Border Patrol agents who, in his case, were guarding this remote ravine where we were. You can move them into San Diego. You can move them into other areas and let the fence do the deterrence. So he was kind of doing a sales job on why more fence is good.
Okay. So then you also just recently were in Tijuana, as you said. What was it back in I'm remembering late last year in November at one point in time,
yeah.
the influx of migrants was so great there that Tijuana officials were trying to house people in a sports complex, right? A stadium,
exactly.
Essentially. That they tried to put 6,000 people in a stadium that was only designed for 2,000. They moved folks out of there. So what's the situation on the ground there now? What did you see?
Yeah, great question, Meghna. The situation is really fluid, and so the numbers are down sharply. Most people in town told us there are fewer than 2,000 of those original Central American migrants left. Some have gone back voluntarily to Honduras. Some have been deported. Chief Scott told us that they have arrested more than 2,500 of the Central American migrants for crossing illegally. And then we're up to 1,600, 1,700 families have passed through the port of entry and are asking for asylum. But as I said, you still see them kind of milling around town. Tijuana plans on closing its main shelter now. It's called El Barretal, and it's a few miles in the city from the border. And they're really encouraging migrants to either go back home or take work in Tijuana. And this is what's interesting is that there's lots of work there. And some of these foreign assembly plants, the maquiladoras, are looking for workers. There's work as masons and construction, selling things in the market. And, quite a few of these Hondurans have said, it's just so hard to get into the U.S. and it's so dangerous and we're afraid that, you know, the president is going to detain us. We're just going to stay here in northern Mexico and work and try to save money and send some back. So they're sort of changing their plans. So it's, you know, it's kind of all over the map.
Okay. So in that case, I mean, is that sort of the confluence of what's happening in Tijuana, the confluence of a surge in the number of migrants? And then also, you know, as we know, the Trump administration's policy of changing the asylum application process, making it harder to get in. Is it sort of the confluence of those two things happening there at the same time?
Well, they are very frustrated because there are only about 40 to 60 individuals that are able to get into the U.S. and ask for asylum every day. There's still a couple of thousand that are waiting, and they've been there for 2 months now. And, you know, we went to one shelter that was opened by an evangelical church on the edge of town, and it's just really squalid. There's an open drainage sewage creek with these big hogs all rooting around, and, you know, kids are playing in the area. There's a trash fire going. These people have been living in the sanctuary in tents for weeks and weeks now and really getting frustrated. One grandmother told us, are we going to go and we're going to try to climb the wall and sort of surrender and get arrested? Do we wait our place in line? Do we go back to Honduras? They're really at wit's end about what to do, largely because of the slow trickle that immigration authorities are allowing in. And I should add, I was in Juarez across from El Paso, Texas, right before Christmas. And the line there, the wait is 5 days. Hmm. So this is so poorly thought out that everyone is massed in Tijuana waiting weeks and weeks to get in when they actually could go to other border cities where the wait is less than a week.
So, John, you've been reporting extensively from the entire border region. You're our NPR Southwest correspondent. So I was wondering if I could just get what your thoughts were to this very, you know, bracing quote that appeared in a New York Times piece from an unnamed Department of Homeland Security official who had to speak on the condition of anonymity, who said, quote, yeah, it's the complete 100% focus on harsher options that will deter the influx with a disregard for managing what's happening. We have a lot more families, a lot more unaccompanied children, and the focus has just been on how we can deter rather than how we can handle. The implication from this unnamed official being that the crisis is either being generated or exacerbated by the administration's own policy.
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. I mean, I think there's some truth to that, and there are parts of that that I don't know that I agree with. Customs and Border Protection, you know, which is the agency over the Border Patrol, says that 50 migrants a day are being sent in for medical care. 2,000 migrants a day are being apprehended. The number of family units that are crossing now is at an all-time high. The trip up from Central America is incredibly rigorous, and some of these children are very small, probably were not well to begin with, and so they are arriving ill, and they're getting worse once they get in these Border Patrol facilities, and so you know, they're choosing to ask for asylum in these ports of entry or to cross illegally.
You know, John, forgive me for interrupting you there. We got to take a quick break, and I know you've been working nonstop for a while, so I'm going to give your voice a rest for at least a minute here. John Burnett is NPR's Southwest correspondent covering immigration, border affairs, and Texas news, and we're talking about the humanitarian crisis at the U.S. border. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the situation at the border, the humanitarian crisis at the border regarding the large influx of migrants that have come to the border, and whether or not, or what role, the Trump administration's own policies have played in exacerbating this crisis. We're joined today by John Burnett. He's with us from San Diego, California. He's NPR's Southwest correspondent covering immigration, border affairs, and Texas news. He was embedded with Border Patrol agents yesterday and recently also reported from the other side of the U.S.-Mexico border in Tijuana. And John, I just want to play a little bit more of your reporting for listeners. It's just terrific reporting. This is from a piece that you gathered back in December when you spoke over the phone to Father Jose Guadalupe Valdez, a priest who runs a migrant shelter in Piedras Negras, a Mexican city along the northeast edge of the border. And in this cut, you're going to hear John translating for Father Guadalupe as he explains the shelter's capacity is nearing critical.
If this comes to pass, we will not be able to support all the migrants who will be waiting here, he said. Piedras Negras is small. They'll need to get jobs.
That's from a reporting that John Burnett brought to us in December. Now, John, before the break, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there for us to take a break, but you were talking about how complicated the situation at the border is and whether or not or how much of a role Trump administration deterrence policies are playing there.
If I could just finish the thought, Meghna, the criticism is that Customs and Border Protection should have anticipated that larger numbers of really vulnerable immigrants, of families and small children and unaccompanied kids, were coming up increasingly in these remote areas where the Border Patrol facilities, sometimes all they have are forward operating bases with, you know, no medical facilities, no way to accommodate children and mothers. And that this has exacerbated the problem. You know, we know that two Guatemalan children have died while in U.S. custody, and those are under investigation. There's been a lot of criticism of that. So that's, you know, that stands out there also. And then when I talked to Padre Pepe in Piedras Negras, he was very concerned that if migrants continue to back up in these Mexican border cities, there's just no way that Mexico can accommodate them. They're not set up for that. I mean, these are all migrant cities. These are transit cities, but they're not, you know, they can handle dozens, you know, maybe a few hundred, but they can't handle any more than that. And the Trump policies, what they want to do is they want all of the migrants to wait in Mexico while their cases are being heard in immigration court. And Mexico has balked at that.
I see. Okay. So John, then, but tell me more. I mean, I think what I'd really love to hear as much as possible from you is, we can talk about the policies, and we will absolutely more throughout this hour, but you're there. You've been reporting from there. What are other things you've seen, other places you've been, shelters you've visited? When is it fair for us to use this big term, crisis?
Well, some shelters are more in crisis than the others. I mean, the one that I visited in Juarez across from El Paso was rather orderly. Again, the wait was about 5 days. It was quite remarkable. The Mexican immigration authorities had a sort of system to shuttle the migrants to the bridge each day to those whose number was up so they could cross and they could ask for asylum. And then if you go across in El Paso, it's called Annunciation House. And we're hearing from there that immigration authorities had been releasing, literally thousands of immigrants onto the streets of El Paso without any notice and without any place to go. And this shelter has been scrambling to rent hotel rooms for them. And to try to, get food and clothing and help them on their journey farther into the U.S. where they'll await their asylum cases. I read a piece last night that the numbers have fallen off sharply, and now they're down to a couple of hundred a day. So it's so fluid. It just changes all the time. But, these humanitarian crises, they're on both sides of the border, and they're sort of episodic, and they're here and they're there. Mm-hmm. And the policies keep changing with the Trump administration. And so you just have to, you're continually chasing the story.
Right. Well, you're listening to John Burnett. He's NPR's Southwest correspondent. Just yesterday, he was embedded with Border Patrol agents. And earlier in the week, he was in Tijuana, Mexico, reporting on the situation with migrants seeking to enter the United States from there. John, stand by here for just a second, because I want to bring in another person into this conversation, if I may. Joining us now from Washington is Congressman Henry Cuellar. He's a Democrat from Texas. He represents Texas's 28th congressional district. It's an area south of San Antonio that also covers a good deal of the U.S.-Mexico border. He's a member of the House Appropriations Committee, and his district is in an area where the president is visiting. Congressman Cuellar, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. Pleasure being with you.
So let me first ask you, I mean, I'm seeing numbers here that the number of detainees that Immigration and Customs Enforcement facilities are housing right now has reached the highest point ever, some 45,000 single adults and family units. And in fact, it's so overcrowded that ICE is now sometimes dropping off people just at bus stations, some 600 migrants dropped off with no advance planning in El Paso in the last full week of December. I mean, what's your sense? Like, what are you seeing or hearing about what's going on in your district, first of all?
Well, generally, you have the same thing. Look, this is what's happened. ICE, or if it's the nonprofits that hold the kids, the unaccompanied kids, just do not have sufficient detention beds. So therefore, if there's not enough sufficient beds, what they do is they generally drop them off at bus stations, and then at the bus stations, they will call family members or friends or wherever they might have. In other parts of the United States, they'll send them the money, buy the tickets, and then from there they take off and wait for the court hearing at a later time. As you know, most of the time it might take 3 to 4 years before they have a court hearing. That generally is what's happened under many administrations, Obama, Bush, and of course now under Trump. The only difference is, you know, Trump is trying to hold as many people to, quote, get rid of the catch and release. So he's holding a lot more people. Therefore, the detention beds or the nonprofit facilities are just really, you know, completely full. And that's why they're still allowing people where they take them out and drop them off at bus stations so they can find family members in other parts of the country.
Hmm. Now, I want to play a piece of tape for you, Congressman Cuellar. This is from Tuesday night when the president addressed the nation from the Oval Office. And here's what he said about the growing number of migrants at the border.
Every day, Customs and Border Patrol agents encounter thousands of illegal immigrants trying to enter our country. We are out of space to hold them, and we have no way to promptly return them back home to their country.
That's the president on Tuesday. Representative Cuellar, I mean, the administration has asked, yes, of course, for $5 billion for a border wall or fence. But in their appropriations request, they've also said, look, we would like to have $800 million to respond to these urgent humanitarian needs that are coming with taking all these migrants into custody. Is there a way? I know Democrats are adamantly opposed to any funding for a border wall, but is there a way to appropriate that, at least that $800 million that DHS says it needs to cope with the situation at the border?
Absolutely. And we've done that. We've provided money for space and for medical officers. We've done a lot of that in the past. But the problem is that the president doesn't really want to hear any of that. He just wants to focus on the border wall because his campaign promise was to build a wall, and the other part of his campaign promise was to let Mexico pay for it. So that's what he's obsessed with. That's what he's focusing in. He thinks that the only border security is by having a wall, and he's just wrong. And what we need to do is look at personnel, technology. Make sure we have the right practices because, you know, a lot of times the drug organizations and the smuggling organizations will change tactics, and we need to change tactics there. And that's what we need to focus on. Look, let me give you an example of what's happening right now. Border Patrol, under the Obama administration, we were at 21,400 and something, almost 21,500. Right now, we're short about 2,000 men and women in Border Patrol. We're about at 19,400. So what does the administration do? They put out a contract for $297 million to help them hire Border Patrol. Well, they just awarded out of that contract, they just let go $14.8 million. You know how many Border Patrol they hired with that, with the 14.8? Two of them. Now, I don't know if one of them is Captain America or what's so special, but if you're going to spend $14.8 million, I'd rather spend that money on retention bonuses so we can hire and retain those Border Patrol, and that's what we need to focus on. Technology, a lot of that technology, the aerostats, mm-hmm. the drones, the cameras that the military use, if it works for the military, it should work for us.
Okay.
So, again, we got to be smart on how we do this. Finally, if I can ask,
sure.
Just say this. Stop drugs. He talked about stopping drugs. Most drugs will come through ports of entry, not in between ports. So if you want to stop drugs, modernize those ports of entry, put the personnel, put the x-ray machines, and that's how you're going to stop drugs.
So, Congressman Cuellar, though, let's focus for a second more on the influx of migrant families, right? In November, there was the highest number ever, more than 20,000, family units, I should say. I mean, what I understand the Democrats, including you, are very critical of the administration's treatment of these families. But what is the Democratic plan or solution to stem the influx of parents with children or to help deal with these migrant families?
Look, I live on the border, and I've seen how the typical profile of somebody coming across has changed. In, 20, 30 years ago, it was a young man that was coming over to come work. get money, send the money back to the family, go back, and then come back again, almost like a temporary guest worker, if I can say that. Now we are now seeing family units. Sometimes our company kids are they're coming over here. So the profile has changed. So we got to ask ourselves, what's happening in those countries? So back in 2014, 2015, we added, I sit on the appropriations, we added, and I pushed very hard for this, to put $750 million a year to help the Central American countries so we can go ahead and provide security, create more jobs over there so less people will come over here. What's happening right now? Out of that money that's been appropriated, there's about $800 million that are still in the pipeline that the administration hasn't let go. They cut down the funding for those countries. If there's a problem with those three countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, then we need to keep working with those countries so less people come over here. Finally, the last thing we did, back in 2015, we added $80 million to help Mexico secure the southern border. They were stopping at that time 220,000 people a year that were coming over to the U.S. that Border Patrol would have never seen because they were stopped over there. So, again, my point is this. Either you play defense on the one-yard line called the U.S.-Mexico border where we spend $18 billion a year, or we play defense on the 20-yard line and put a little bit of money in Central America, Mexico, to address some of those core issues.
But Congressman, if I may ask, and the dates you're giving me, if I heard you correctly, are appropriations that were made during the Obama administration. Are you saying that the money wasn't adequately or appropriately used even under the Obama administration?
No. What I'm saying, well, part of, yeah, they took a long time to get that. But every year, we started off at $750 million for Central America under the Obama administration. And we had a lot of meetings with those countries, with the presidents, with the ambassadors. We finally agreed to where the money was going to be spent with those three countries. Then when the Trump administration came in, they lowered that down from $750 million a year. They lowered it down to $595 million, even though we wanted more, but the Republicans controlled everything. Now we're going to change that. Now we're in. But under the Trump administration, there is money that's been obligated for the last couple of years that's already obligated. It has already been appropriated. And there's about $800 million in the pipeline that we can get over to them. And I've talked to the president of Honduras. I've talked to other ambassadors from those three countries. And they're saying, when are we going to get the resources? We're trying to address the situation here, but there's $800 million is still stuck. So what I did is I put a spending plan so they can appropriate or so they can release that money or those resources down to those areas and address the economy and the security issues in those three Central American countries.
Okay. And last question, Congressman, that's the big picture about dealing, as you said, with the issues in the Central American countries themselves. But once again, regarding the families that are already and the family units that are already here at the border, do Democrats have a plan to assist or to alleviate this problem?
Yes. And in fact, in appropriations, you know, I've added language there too and resources to make sure that if anybody's detained, that we take care of those people, that families are not separated, and to get immigration judges so they can get the hearings as soon as possible so people will know if they're going to stay or go back, depending on their asylum or credible fear. They've done that. So we've done that, and we intend to do more. And so we have a plan. The only thing, our plan for border security doesn't include a wall. Finally, let me say the last thing. The president keeps talking about a crisis over there, and I have to say this. The latest FBI statistics, and I do this every year, the national murder rate in the United States is 5.3 murders per 100,000. The border crime rate for murders is lower than the national crime rate. So when the president visits McAllen, the murder rate there in McAllen is about 4.8 murder rates, which is lower than the national crime rate. Washington, D.C., where the president's at, is the murder rate is 16.7 murder rate. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot more dangerous here in Washington, D.C., and I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about the murder rate, than where he's going to be in McAllen, Texas. It's safer there, and that's the safest place he's going to be at when he visits the border.
Well, Congressman Henry Cuellar, he's a Democrat representing Texas's 28th Congressional District. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
John Burnett, NPR Southwest correspondent, you've been patiently listening to the congressman there. We got about a minute to go here before we have to take a quick break, but I was wondering if you just want, you had a quick response to what you heard him say.
Yeah, I was actually in Guatemala, in Huehuetenango province, which is the contributes more illegal migrants to the U.S. than any other province in Guatemala. That was last fall. And we saw firsthand why people are leaving and how they're coming up and the desperation they have. You know, earning $5 a day is the max some of these campesinos can earn. And so, yes, job creation, more security, and a focus on corruption so that they can improve these small villages and, you know, the mayors and the governors, you know, don't put it all in their pockets.
Well, that's John Burnett, NPR Southwest correspondent covering immigration and border affairs. John, stand by with us for just a second. We're going to get to a bunch of calls when we come back. We're talking about the reality on the ground, on the border, about the crisis situation there, and if it is a crisis and what its dimensions are. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. We're talking about the reality on the ground regarding the crisis of the influx of migrants and migrant families in particular, and what to do about it, and whether or not or how the Trump administration's own policies have contributed or exacerbated this crisis. We're joined today by John Burnett. He's NPR's Southwest correspondent covering immigration and border affairs. He was embedded with Border Patrol agents yesterday and previously was in Tijuana a little earlier this week, seeing what the situation is like on the ground there. Earlier in this hour, we mentioned a little bit about how there have been so many parents with children amongst the approximately 2,000 migrants who are taken into federal custody each day that authorities in some places, including El Paso, are resorting to mass releases of families right onto the streets of the city. This has been going on for a couple of weeks. And in late December, El Paso Mayor, Republican Mayor Dee Margo, spoke to Fox News about it.
Their holding areas are filled, so they're releasing them. They're understanding they're being processed. Ankle bracelets are being put on the parents, and then they're releasing them as well. But I mean, the bottom line, Rick, is our immigration policy stinks. No one in Washington on either side of the aisles had the fortitude to deal with it historically. And it's about time somebody steps up and develops a little manhood on the way and determines what they need to do, irrespective of the political fallout.
That's El Paso's Mayor Dee Margo back in December on Fox News. Let's go to the callers here quickly. Robert is calling from Riverside, California. Robert, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your thought today, Robert?
Yes, you know, you're asking for opinions on the ground. And I spent 16 years in Mexico. I married a Zapotec woman. It was extremely difficult on all sides. And I would just like to say that my perspective is that we're being played with like pawns by people like Trump who have never touched the ground. And it's a horrific thing that's going on at the border. Families are being destroyed there. And there's a Mexican word for it called desmadres. That means unmothering. And it's like the worst thing that can happen when you really, really destroy the natural orders of things. And that's exactly what we're doing. I'm sorry, I can't talk to you very much I'm having a very difficult time talking to you. This is an extremely difficult call for me to make, and I'm literally on the floor, so I'm going to hang up.
Right. Well, Robert, thank you. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Evan, who's calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. Evan, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that first of all, I do not support this wall. I think Trump holding the country hostage to build this wall is ridiculous. But I wanted to encourage listeners to look at this situation with just some empathy and just try to imagine what it would be like to be one of these people who you're risking your life if you stay at home. And so you go to a place that is objectively safer, and then the people in that place are treating you like this. And I would encourage people to just do some research. Like, look into great journalism from NPR or the New York Times or Vox on just what it's like to be an immigrant, the positive impacts of immigration, and the dangers that these people face where they come from. Because like we shouldn't be punishing these people. It's heartbreaking.
Right. Well, Evan, thank you so much for your call. Let's get one more. Peter is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Yes. Great show and great reporting for the NPR. I'm one of your more conservative listeners. And listen, I think objectively you did a great job. You know, and I think it boils down to this. Either a country has borders, enforceable borders for legal migration, or it doesn't. And with all due respect to the New Yorker and other articles that write stories about, I get it, with people want to come to this country because they come from poverty and they want free stuff. They're not allowed to get that because it's an economic. Everybody claims amnesty, the amnesty for the Indian sanctuary and just to come in. I totally get it, but no historical country, Rome, look at Hadrian's Wall. You had walls, you had a combination. Trump exacerbates things, absolutely. However, you need borders. You need to be able to legally allow people to come in through migration. Mm-hmm. And also, think of the people come, the burdens. They come in sick, illiterate. They can't, they want to get jobs. I totally understand it, but we can't pay for everything. If everybody from South America and Asia could come to America on a bridge, they would.
Peter, I have a question. Isn't Peter, I appreciate your call a lot, but what you just said about migrants seeking entry into the United States now about being ill and perhaps not being literate, I mean, isn't that exactly the same thing that was said of Irish and Italian immigrants in the 19th century?
No, the difference was back then in the 1840s and 50s when my people came over we needed live bodies to come into the country. You needed people to study, and they served in the army, the military. You needed people. Now we do not need. There's plenty of people. We need highly educated. We need people that can contribute. You don't need people to come in and unfortunately who are sick, who are going to take welfare benefits, who are going to be people, they come in with one family works and they're taking thousands of dollars or more of benefits. It's taxpayers who pay for it. And again, I just cite from history, no country has existed since time immemorial.
Right.
It can just take people and allow comes. And it's simple economics. I think it has to be tempered to take care of your own people.
Well, Peter, thank you so very much for your call. That's Peter from Boston, Massachusetts. John Burnett, a strong degree or, excuse me, variety of opinions there from people.
Yes, yes.
But I'm sure, I mean, since you've been reporting from the border for so long, I mean, is it reflective of the variety of opinions of people, you know, living on the border themselves?
If I could just respond to Peter, you know, I had this incredible opportunity last month to go actually to Central Europe, and I was in Germany, and we looked at borders and refugees and immigration. And, you know, Angela Merkel allowed more than a million migrants to cross her border from Austria, and it caused a huge upset in her country. And there's an enormous debate going on there that parallels our debate about how many immigrants do you let in? How many benefits do you give them? Do we let them stay in Germany and work? Do we, if they don't have legitimate claims for protection from fleeing persecution, do we throw them out again? It's the exact same debate that we're having. Germany has borders too. People are allowed to come to a nation's borders in much of the world and ask for protection. This is international law. And so the people that are coming to the United States, many of them are doing this and asking for asylum. They're not just, you know, running willy-nilly into the country and, you know, trying to evade the Border Patrol. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is actually, this country does need migrant labor. I do the reporting. I mean, I've been to the trailer factories in Paris, Texas, in Northeast Texas, where they just ICE had a big labor raid a couple of months ago, and they arrested a whole lot of undocumented immigrants who were welding together these big industrial steel trailers that you pull behind pickups. And nobody else will do that work up there. And you could say the same thing about people who pick crops or who process chickens.
Right.
It goes across the country like this. We absolutely need skilled labor, as Peter said. But there's a whole lot of work that U.S. citizens are not doing. And just ask the employers.
Mm. Well, John, hang on here for just a second, because in the last couple of minutes of the show, I wanted to just move over to Arizona here for a moment and get a view as to what's happening there. And joining us now is Mary Jo Pitzel. She's with us from Phoenix. She's state government and child welfare reporter for the Arizona Republic. She reported on a video that the Arizona Republic obtained that showed migrant children being dragged, pushed, and slapped in a migrant children's shelter in Youngtown, Arizona. Mary Jo Pitzel, welcome to On Point.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. So first of all, tell us very briefly about this video that the Arizona Republic obtained. What did it show and where did this happen?
This happened in a shelter operated by Southwest Key in a suburb just northwest of Phoenix. And in mid-September, according to the video, their security cameras captured a couple of staffers sort of pushing and dragging and shoving some very recalcitrant kids through a conference room from one room into another. Well, we don't have a lot of context for it because Southwest Key won't talk about it, but we are aware of it because the video is released to the state health authorities, which licensed the facility, and we went to them and did a records request and got the video to sort of give us a look at what's going on inside these shelters.
Right. Now, forgive me for interrupting, but just for some context here, I'm seeing that Southwest Key is housing more than 1,500 migrant children in Arizona, California, and Texas. 13 of their facilities are in Arizona?
It's down to 11, partially because of the events that involve this incident. This Southwest Key agreed to close two of its shelters, so they are down to 11 facilities.
Okay, and they have a $458 million contract with the federal government under the Unaccompanied Alien Children Program. But the state of Arizona wrote a very strongly worded letter to Southwest Key, basically alleging or accusing them of not really caring for the welfare of the children under their purview. What's that all about?
We started to look through a lot of the inspection reports that the state had done, and we noted and pointed out to the agency that they were getting cited repeatedly for not doing fingerprint checks, background checks on the employees in a timely manner. The director of the health department finally just cracked down and said, look, I want you to go out, Southwest Key, and re-verify the clearances of all of your employees and get it done by this date. They didn't meet the deadline, and the director blew up and said, "Okay, we're gonna suspend operations unless you come to the table, and we're gonna work out some kind of a settlement agreement," which is what resulted in two of these shelters being closed.
Okay, so I'm also seeing through your reporting crowded bedrooms, the children lacking privacy in some of these Southwest Key facilities. I mean, is the oversight appropriate now? Has the problem been fixed? And by the way, I should also just ask you, Mary Jo, how long are the children being held in the facilities there in Arizona?
Well, it's really, really hard to tell. It's a very opaque process. And at this point, partially because of this incident of the kids being obviously maltreated, it's under a criminal review by prosecutors, so that has shut everybody up. Southwest Key will not talk. We're not getting census counts out of the shelters right now. And it's hard to tell how long the children stay there. They, you know, will cycle through until they can reunite them with a family member or a friend in the U.S., or if necessary, send them back to family across the border.
Okay. Well, Mary Jo Pitzel, state government and child welfare reporter for the Arizona Republic, joining us today from Phoenix. She's been reporting extensively on Southwest Key and the facilities that it runs, housing some 1,500 migrant children in Arizona and California, I should say, but she's been focusing specifically on Arizona. We have links, by the way, to Mary Jo's reporting at onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mary Jo.
Thank you so much.
All right, John Burnett, we've just got a couple of minutes left here, so I want to at least get one or two more calls in before we run out of time. Raul is calling from Joplin, Missouri. Raul, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You know, I lived in McAllen for a few years, worked down there, and a lot of the influx of customers that we had coming from the border, I mean, it was a large part of our commerce, basically, in the town. And I just wonder how a wall is going to make us look in the context of, you know, a global economy. I mean, how is that going to make us look if we have a giant border wall when it's obviously a source of income that we depend on, especially in McAllen, Texas? I mean, we look forward to that money coming in. And if we put a giant border there, I mean, what's that going to make us look like?
Mm. Well, Raul, thank you so much for your call. Let's get one more. Scott is calling from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Scott, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is the Republicans have been just clueless. They've been barking at shadows in the dark for so long. It goes back to our American policy over 100 years ago, Firestone, how we got coffee. It's, you know, if we'd only helped them in Central America early on, then we wouldn't be, you know, how we got our rubber, how we got our coffee. We just exploited these people for, and we keep the division. Look at how Ollie North treated them. Mm-hmm. You know, how we've just propped up bad guys all over the South America. It's just been really sad. And then, you know, Trump equals hate with this wall. It just really does. And like I say, Republicans have been barking at shadows in the dark for so long. Mitch McConnell and company, they need to pay a political price. They've enabled this president to do horrible things. Mm. He's a racist. They're bigots. They've been gaslighting us for so long. But the real distraction, it's just such a... Every day is a distraction.
Mm.
Thanks,
Scott,
to Trump.
Yeah, Scott, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just got to wrap up the show here. Got a couple minutes left. Scott from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, thank you for your call. John Burnett, you're there in San Diego today. I've been reporting all along the border for many months here. There's one last piece of tape that you have gathered that I want to play to help us sort of wrap up and how we think about the situation there now. And this is something that you reported on in November when you spoke to Luis, a Honduran mother who'd been separated from her 15-year-old son after arriving from the United States. They were reunited in October after being apart for 5 months. And Luis, through an interpreter, though, had this warning. This is late last year for other migrant mothers.
It's horrible. I'm advising the mothers, if you don't want to have your children taken from you, don't come here.
She said, figure something else out. And John, that's from a report that you put on NPR in November. We've got about 30 seconds left here to go. What's your final thought for us on how we should be considering what's actually happening on the border there now?
Well, the family separation policy was suspended by the Trump administration after a huge national and international outcry. So, you know, families are largely being kept together while they're crossing. But this movement of immigrants is all around the country. It's a historic move around the globe, whether it's from West Africa or Syria or Afghanistan or Central America. We are not alone. The United States is experiencing the same problems with international movement of refugees that a lot of countries are. This is our moment in history, and it's chaotic all over.
Well, John Burnett, NPR's Southwest correspondent, speaking to us today from San Diego. It's been a real pleasure to have you on, John. Thank you so very much for your reporting.
Thank you, Meghna. It's really been a pleasure being on the show.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.